welcome to The Dividing Line. It is Wednesday. We're cramming three programs into the week before Christmas, because it's the week before Christmas. And wife and I intend to... The wife and I intend to be with the grandkids for... Well, we had them at our place last year. This year we have to go to where they are, and so... We didn't even put up a real tree this year. I almost hit the button at Amazon. I almost got the Charlie Brown Christmas tree. They've got the little one, and it's got one little thing on it, so it's great. I almost got it. Just because, I mean, that's great. It's a great Christmas tree. But I got one of the, it's a total of 3 feet tall, but the base is like this big. So it's about 2.5 foot tall fiber optic thing. That's all we did. Except, you know, because my wife was like, well, we're not having the kids over. So, you know, it's just us and, you know, and we're not going to be here and stuff. And then she ends up going nuts outside. There's Christmas things hanging on. All this stuff outside, just not inside. It's like, whatever, fine.
See, we're just the opposite. Outside looks terrible. Inside, we got it all decorated. The only thing I haven't done yet is the train. I don't have the train.
Yeah, you know, we've got a couple trains. The thing that just bugs me is they're none of them the same size. So I guess you can have little trains running around bigger trains, but...
Oh, that's the best way to do it. And you just use your imagination. I have N-scale trains.
We have cats and no kids.
I have a cat, and N-scale trains about that big.
Yeah, so. I know. I remember when I got my first train set at age 5 and all the adults played with it. And there's actually a picture. Same thing with you? There's a picture of me because they put it on the table. And here I am looking over the edge at my train set and all the adults... up there doing their thing. It probably explains why I am the way I am today.
Yeah, the train's all about me. It's not about the young, it's about me.
Yeah. Anyway, so, of course, my parents had the same tree for 45 years. 45 years. It was so old we had to stick toothpicks into the holes because the things that you put the branches into wore out. So you had to put toothpicks in to keep them from just going... Anyway... Anyhow, all the anti-Christmas, you're all a bunch of pagan guys are running around with their hair on fire right now going, I don't really care. I don't really care because I have a post Tenebris Lux Tyndale Greek New Testament lambskin, and I just used some of their Bible butter on it. So it's just, so, and you don't. So I don't care. No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I don't know. Anyways, what in the world are we doing here? All right. So our website was under attack, and we're still working on fending all that off. Yeah, there's just people in the world that have nothing to do in life. So that's why we posted the live links and stuff on straight to YouTube and put it on Facebook and Twitter and stuff like that, because those guys are pretty much immune to that kind of thing. So whoever's out there doing that, get a life. It's the holidays. Then there's some other people I'd like to tell get a life. But that's another story. If you have your Bible, I'd like to, it's Christmas. And so I'd like to think about some of the things that the scriptures say that are extremely relevant to so many of the groups that we deal with over the years. Anytime we delve into the text of scripture, we're doing things that will be helpful to doing apologetics. And this is rather practical. So many Christians today are in families with skeptics and unbelievers that, especially this time of year, you can end up in some fairly serious conversations. In fact, it might be one of the only times during the year when you have even the opportunity to have conversations, and it might be the subject of Christmas and of the incarnation is what will allow you to open up certain areas of conversation. As a result, some of the more common attacks, statements of skepticism, you want to be prepared for. And I think all Christians should be prepared and aware of these things. So, for example, and this is one of the most important ones. Cold water is so good. When New Testament writers, when Matthew especially, cites from the Old Testament, more and more people, this was, again, I keep contrasting these things, but my grandparents did not have to minister in a context where even 1%, even a half a percent of the population would have been exposed to skeptical scholarship as a part of their upbringing and their education. Now, it's the vast majority of people we're dealing with have been exposed to a skeptical upbringing. And hence, I would imagine that many people in my grandparents' generation, certainly my great-grandparents' generation, lived where they could quote from Isaiah 7:14 and never get pushback. Never from anybody. Isaiah 7:14, therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, an Alma will be with child and bear a son, and she will call his name Emmanuel. And so the normative presentation of this text, if a Christian is even familiar with it, will be, oh, virgin birth, and Emmanuel means God with us, which means Jesus is God, and he's with us, and therefore there's the deity of Christ. And like I said, I would imagine only a few decades ago, if you had been presented with that, almost no one would have had a pushback. Now, that's not the case. And we have to be prepared. We have to be aware of what the text is actually saying, what its context is, so that its true meaning can be defended and presented and understood, and that we don't find ourselves defending things we shouldn't defend. So, for example, even atheists are aware of the fact that the Hebrew term Alma in Isaiah 7:14 does not technically mean virgin. And when you hear that, when you get that, it is, by the way, it is, you know how dry it got? Where was that? I think up like Mount Lemmon or something. I saw something from the news. During that last cold front that came through, the dew point got to almost 50 degrees below zero. Do you have any idea that there is no water in that air at all? It is dry right now. Dry, 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 dry. So if you see me chugging down the water, there's a reason for that. It is very, very, very dry in the desert right now. Now, when you hear someone say that Alma does not mean virgin, the immediate thought is to defend what you thought you had been taught in the past. And that's how many Christians find themselves in situations of defending what you don't need to be defending. What, in fact, you can't defend because it's not true. Alma, in the Hebrew language, can simply mean a young woman of marriageable age. there is nothing that demands that it mean virgin, but it doesn't exclude virgins. It's just a young woman of marriageable age. The assumption would be if she's not married that she's a virgin. So within that context, the assumed meaning, if unmarried, would be of a virgin. But it could also refer to a young woman of marriageable age who has been married and therefore wouldn't necessarily be a virgin. So what does that mean? Because if you've just been taught, well, here's the virgin birth plainly laid out for us in the Old Testament, you need to understand something about citation of the Old Testament and the utilization of the Old Testament in the New Testament. And this is a huge area. This is, let's just put it this way. It's an area pretty much outside of Christmas turkey or whatever it is you do for Christmas discussion at the table, probably. It's a big area. Entire books, huge books, tomes have been written on this particular subject. But what you don't need to be doing as a Christian is attempting to argue against the lexical meaning of Alma. Who was it recently? I was in a debate. Oh, yeah. I was with the fellow at Jason's church, the former Mormon, former Christian, now off into some other weirdness. He brought up Alma. And was trying to say something about, and I was saying, no, the word means a young woman of marriageable age. Could be virgin, might not be virgin. That's not what Matthew is quoting from. It's like, what? Despite the fact that Matthew is writing to Jews, he is quoting from the Greek Septuagint. And the Greek Septuagint has a specific term. Right here, and I guess we're not going to be putting these up, but, well, I thought we had other people working on the site.
Yeah, I'm watching them.
Okay. In other words, Rich wasn't paying attention before. He's distracted with other things. So, it's so small, who's going to see that? Behold, the virgin, the Parthenos en gastri, shall be with child, and shall bear a son, and you shall call, and the name shall be called to him, Emmanuel. So here you have the term, Parthenos. We are familiar with the Parthenos in Athens, and Parthenos is the specific technical word for virgin. It does not mean young woman of marriageable age. And this is what Matthew is quoting from. He's quoting from the Greek Septuagint. So when he makes the connection to the virgin birth of Christ, he is accurately representing what the version of the scriptures that he's quoting to his audience represents. So the question is the relationship between Parthenos and Ha'alma. Is Parthenos a verifiably accurate translation of Alma? Well, Alma is not as specific as Parthenos. But the New Testament writer quotes the more specific application because its fulfillment is being found in a very specific application in the virgin birth of Jesus. Now, there is no question that there was an initial fulfillment of the prophecy of Isaiah 7:14. You have to read it in context. Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. because the king had been told to ask for a sign, he wouldn't do it. So the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, a virgin will be with child and bear a son. She will call his name Emmanuel. He will eat curds and honey at the time he knows enough to refuse evil and choose good. For before the boy will know enough to refuse evil and choose good, the land whose two kings you dread will be forsaken. So, there is no question that in the original context, this is a given sign to the king that he does not have to fear the two kings that he's feared, and that before the boy will know enough to refuse evil and to choose good. What's that? 2, 3, something like that. The land whose two kings you dread will be forsaken. So there, something's going to go on back home, and there will be deliverance for the king. And so, what does Emmanuel mean? Well, I won't go into it right now, but especially if you're Bible software will allow you to do this, you will see that this is a phrase that occurs a number of times between Isaiah 7 and 11, especially in chapter 8. And it's interesting that the chapter 8 portion is quoted by Peter in 1 Peter 3:15 in the text that we from whence we get our emphasis upon apologetics, which actually identifies Jesus as Yahweh, at least in the best text of the New Testament it does. Point being that you have this emphasis upon a real fulfillment in history. So you have to have a theology of inspiration that allows for a fulfillment in history, but not a final fulfillment. And when you look at all messianic prophecies, well, okay, I won't say all, but almost every single messianic prophecy, as applied in the New Testament, there was a lesser fulfillment in the past. Couple of exceptions, but not too many. So, be aware of the fact that if you're going to quote Isaiah 7:14 and Matthew's citation of it, then be aware of what the background is and be aware of what some of the objections could be and be prepared to say, well, you know, yes, there was a initial fulfillment back then, but there's a greater fulfillment in Christ. And that's why I have, over the years, a couple times preached a sermon where I've gone from Isaiah 6 to Isaiah 11 and just shown all of the, each chapter has a messianic text within it that the New Testament writers picked up. And that includes the phraseology of Emmanuel, which, by the way, if you're going to say, see, Emmanuel means Jesus is God, be careful, because there's lots and lots of Hebrew names with El as a part of it. And that doesn't mean that those people were God. Emmanuel, God with us, would by default be God is on our side. God is with us. God is blessing us. We are God's people, etc., etc. It is only in seeing how that is used with a number of different texts that you start seeing that it's not just God is on our side, but God is with us. Once you start seeing Isaiah chapter 40 and stuff like that, you start seeing that there is a greater fulfillment to come. But it's always important to know the background. And I think there are just a lot of people, they just run into Christians and they find the Christians are proof texting a little text here and proof texting a little text there, and they've never looked at the context. And that doesn't impress. You need to know what the context is. And when you can, all of a sudden, that can open up huge doors. really, really can. It can really open up opportunities. And I'm really hoping that a lot of you will have the chance to have some great conversations with your unsaved friends and relatives, and to be able to do so to his honor and glory. So we have that in Isaiah chapter 7. Isaiah chapter 8, I didn't have this queued up. So let me just see if I... yes, here's the first God is with us is 8:10, which is translated for God is with us in the NASB. But you can see right here, Emmanuel, Emmanuel, with us, God. And that's in Isaiah chapter 8, verse 10. But then you go a little bit just below that, and here's the text you're looking at. You are not to fear what they fear or be in dread of it. It is the Lord of hosts. It is Yahweh, Yahweh Sabaoth, whom you should regard as holy, Kadosh. And this section here in right here, Kurian Autan Hagiasate, is what is quoted by Peter in 1 Peter 3:14, going into 1 Peter 3:15, but is Christ as Kurios that you are to sanctify. The Byzantine manuscripts have a different reading, but the earliest reading very strongly presents the idea of Jesus as Jehovah at this point. So you continue on, and as I recall, yeah, then you go straight into chapter 9, and we know what is found in chapter 9, but it's good to know this, too. I mean, I've only run into one or two people who knew this. But here you have our great text that we all know, for a child will be born to us, a son will be given to us, the government will rest on his shoulders, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. Two things. Be aware that if you brought up the Greek Septuagint in talking about Isaiah 7, notice the reading in the Greek Septuagint. Megales boules angelos. The great angel of his will, probably a reference to one of the archangels. So instead, there is clearly a it's not even variant. That's not really the best. I mean, it is a variant technically. But there is a diversion, a diverse tradition that is being followed in this particular stream of the Greek Septuagint. How's that? I've always wanted to use the Göttingen Septuagint to delve a little bit more deeply into this, but I just haven't gotten around to it yet. But there's a connection between the two. But, you know, great will be his rulership, peace, a lot of the same terminology is used, but it's not a direct translation of the Hebrew. It is at the beginning of the verse. Let me take that back. At the beginning of the verse it is, but there seems to be a divergence in the tradition that's behind, that's being translated by the Greek Septuagint. So you have a paideon agenete here at the beginning. A yelled will be yulated to us. So a child will be born to us, standard term for birth. But then a son will be given to us. And there you have ben nithan to us. So I've said many times before, I can't prove this beyond a shadow of a doubt, but I really do lean towards seeing here something more than mere Hebrew parallelism. It could be parallelism. And what is parallelism? Parallelism is the fact that is the reality of Hebrew writing where you will restate something in a parallel fashion to enrich its meaning. You'll find this throughout the Psalter. So this could just be parallelism. A child will be born to us, a son will be given to us. But there might be more to it than that. The child who is born, that's the standard term for birth. That's the standard term for a little baby who's just been born. A child will be born to us. But a son will be given to us. Now, is that a full-on enunciation of the Trinitarian doctrine of the relationship of the Father and Son? No. Full-on revelation of the Incarnation? No. But is it possible there's more here than just merely the idea of Hebrew parallelism? It's just poetry. I think it is quite possible that in light of its fulfillment in the New Testament, you do have the giving of the Son here. I think it's at least valid to see it in the light of what comes later. And his titles that are given to him, such as Sar Shalom, Prince of Peace, El Gabor, Mighty God, Aviad. Let me mention this too in passing. I wasn't planning on doing all this, but Aviad very frequently throws people for a curve. Eternal Father. Jesus isn't the Father, so how can he be called Eternal Father? Well, you'll notice that in Hebrew, it is one phrase, Aviad. And it refers to the Father of Eternity. Remember that the term Father in the Tanakh is primarily used of God, when it's used of God, it's primarily used of God in the sense of creator, former, maker. So, if Abba, Father, from Aramaic, so Avi, if is being used in that sense, then this would be the Father of Eternity, the Maker of Eternity. And that would fit very, very well with Colossians chapter 1, by him were all things made in heaven and earth, so on and so forth. So what you need to remember is the Trinitarian names of Father, Son, and Spirit are New Testament names. You do have, you know, kiss the Son, lest he be angry with you, and you have a few little references like that. But since this is a phrase, and it's a descriptive phrase, I think it would be best understood as Father of Eternity, that is, the one who created time, which would fit with the fulfillment of Jesus in Colossians chapter 1. And then, of course, Sar Shalom, Shalom, peace, the very same term, Irene, that Paul uses in Romans 5:1, established by the death of Christ, by justification by faith in him, Irene. He is the Prince of Peace. He is the one who brings peace in Isaiah 9. So, just a couple of these texts. And then, of course, we do have one that really doesn't have a primary and then secondary fulfillment. It doesn't have a lesser fulfillment and then a greater fulfillment. And that is the text that the intertestamental Jews were well aware of and saw as an unfulfilled messianic text, Micah 5:2. And when the wise men come and Herod inquires, where will the king of the Jews be born? This is immediately where they go. So that's really clear evidence in the middle of the first century that the Jews understood this text in that particular fashion. But as for you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, New American Standard goes, too little to be among the clans of Judah. From you one will go forth for me to be ruler in Israel. His goings forth are from long ago, from the days of eternity. If I recall correctly, The ESV has a different reading there. No, but you, O Bethlehem Ephrathah, who are too little to be among the clans of Judah. What was I reading recently that had... It had the translation was not least amongst the clans of Judah, something along those lines, is what I recall it saying. I thought it might have been ESV, but see, the NET has seemingly insignificant among the clans of Judah. Yeah, so it's an interesting Hebrew phrase there. But the point is, they pointed to Bethlehem, and this is the reason that the wise men go there, and then you have the dream, and you have the murder of the little children, and the flight of the Holy Family, and all the rest of that stuff going on within that context of Micah 5:2. But as for you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, to little me among clans of Judah, from you one will go forth from me to be ruler in Israel, his goings forth from long ago, from the days of eternity. You know, some people get upset with me, and I upset all sorts of people. I may need another glass of water before I get down here. It is just ridiculous. I'm really struggling. Why would people get upset with me? Well, there's a lot of reasons. The older I get, the more reasons people seem to find. But one of the things is that I make you have to do a little bit more work. In other words, used to just be able to quote some verses, and then that James White fella came along and said, well, you need to remember that the context of this is this, the context of that is that, and be prepared for that, and blah, until that prepares you for a witnessing situation, and then I hear from those folks going, man, I'm glad you told me about that. So here's another, maybe one of your favorite verses. And you may not like to be told how people abuse it or interpret it in a different way, but I'm just trying to help out. Honest, I really am. Because the Jehovah's Witnesses understand this term right here. So, goings forth... activities, origination, see the New World Translation, and you know what? I've got to order the new NWT. It's been years. And I need to order that, especially because for some reason the electronic version on my phone keeps crashing. But let me grab this down here. Oh, great. I just realized this is the iStrain version. A little, they're, I guess they're silver now. I need to get that. Excuse me, everybody. Just, remember in Star Trek Wrath of Khan? when Kirk has to get the thing, has to read the stuff for Reliance computer code. Anyways, I'm letting far too many people know that I am a complete, utter geek about that stuff. Here we go. There it is. That's what I thought. The New World Translation of Jehovah's Witnesses says, "And you, O Bethlehem Ephrathah, the one too little to get to be among the thousands of Judah, from you there will come out to me the one who is to become ruler in Israel, whose origin is from early times, from the days of time indefinite. And so a Jehovah's Witness, man, what year did I get this? I didn't write it in there. That's a shame. This is the 84 revision, so, yeah, I need to, I wonder if you can just get those off of JW.org. JW.Amazon.com. that's where you get the nice version. I wonder if anyone's ever sent Jeffrey Rice a New World Translation to be to be rebound. Don't give people ideas. Remember when I met with that Jehovah's Witness guy? Remember, I've told the story many times before, where DL took me to meet with this. It was with an employee of his, but his employee brought this elder along, and he was the guy that slipped me a handwritten note of Greek to test if I could read it. No, it wasn't upside down. He just miswritten one letter, but he had been carrying it around in his New World Translation. And so when I said, yes, I can read that, he says, really? And so he opens up his New World Translation. He gets out this yellow piece of paper. I think it was yellow naturally, but opens it up and slides it over to me and says, what does that say? Now, that it is hard to read a fragment when you don't know what a context is or anything else. But thankfully, he had taken it from the New Testament. And I said, well, you miswrote that letter right there, but it says, let no one deceive you with empty words. And he looked like he had seen a ghost. He said, I've been carrying this thing for more than 20 years. No one's ever been able to read it. You're the first person who is ever able to read that correctly. Well, once I introduced myself to him, found out he knew who I was. And he's a Jehovah's Witness that wishes he could do in apologetics for Jehovah's Witnesses what I do. And we ended up having a very, very interesting encounter and conversation. And so I just wonder if somebody like that would, you know, want to have a really, really, really nice, the only New World Translation like it, you know, can you imagine? So I don't think Jeffrey would do it. I think he'd do it for me because he'd know how I would use it, but I don't know. Remember, I think, yeah, I'm 99% certain. I think this was done by our Jehovah's Witness friend. Because back when I was first learning the languages, this is actually two different volumes that have been bound together. Biblia Hebraica Stuttgartensia and... I was partnering with heretics. Well, but we were doing it to open up doors of witness to this guy. And he also did a really very, very good job. I mean, this is in the 1980s. A couple of my initial Greek New Testaments were actually done by a Jehovah's Witness. So there you go. Anyways, what were we talking about? So Moses is in the bulrushes, and the point is that the New World Translation has the term origin. And so a Jehovah's Witness will go to Micah 5:2 and will say, see, he began. This is his origins are from long ago. But from their perspective, Jesus is Michael the Archangel. See, he's the first and greatest of God's creations. The only thing that God created directly is Michael the Archangel, who becomes Jesus. So it's through Michael the Archangel that everything else is created. So they will use Micah 5:2. Now, there's nothing in that specific Hebrew word that demands the idea of origination or creation. But there are a number of Old Testament texts that Jehovah's Witnesses especially will utilize, Unitarians as a whole, who aren't Jehovah's Witnesses, will utilize to try to say that this is indicative of a point of origination. Micah 5:2 is one of them, so you need to be aware of that. And in the same way, the assertion being from days of long ago, from the days of eternity, going back into the eternal past. It's not really discussing anything other than the one who obviously isn't just a human leader, because these will not be words used of a prophet, a king, anybody like that. That's why I say this is one prophecy. It doesn't have an initial and then later fulfillment, a lesser fulfillment, greater fulfillment type theme involved. And the intertestamental Jews knew that. That's why when Herod says, where will the king be, the Jews born? Bethlehem. Bethlehem. They brought him this specific prophecy. And they were exactly right in what they said there. So there you go. All right. A couple of Old Testament texts proper to our season. And then yesterday, and thanks to everybody who wished me well yesterday. My daughter put up a tweet that has over 400 responses this morning to it. Birthday tweet. I very much appreciated that. And Jeff put up a real nice thing and had like 150, 160 comments on it. And I appreciate all that. I'll just be perfectly honest with you. Once you get to this age, birthdays just ain't what they used to be. And one of the only reasons that I even notice it anymore, a couple years it'll be the big 6-0. We'll do something. You're right there. I mean, you don't look a day over 70 either, so I think it's really good. Between now and then, it's just sort of like just glad to have gotten through. Yeah, thanks. Yeah, glad to have gotten through. Grecian formula works. There's your proof. Oh yeah. Oh hey, you know, he's put his head way down. Look at you may think you still got your hair, but I'm glad you weren't pulling a little bit farther back, because son, you might want to be making sure to wear a hat when it's sunny outside. That's all I can say. Or you could end up getting a pretty good sunburn yourself.
And may I once again remark about my rocking proper sweater today? Just saying.
Yep. Some people can just only handle so many colors at once. So, anyways, yesterday I did my. I have a tradition. I started when I was 43, so this is the 14th year I've done it. Of trying to climb 100 feet on bike for every year of age. So the first year was 4,300 feet, then 4,400 feet. And the problem with that is the older you get, the harder it gets.
Well, aren't you at some point going to run out of Arizona elevation?
No, because I did mine yesterday inside. So I did Zwift. And Zwift has mountains that you can just climb over and over again and just keep on going. And well, I do that even when I was going to do South Mountain. But it was cold yesterday. It was literally cold yesterday. And so I'm sort of glad I did it inside. For some reason, the older you get, the less your muscles want to work in the cold. That's my experience. Anyway, but before I got on bike, I posted a little something on Facebook. And the more I've looked at it, the more fascinated I've become with this. So very quickly, we only have about 15 minutes. 2 Timothy chapter 4. Paul's writing to Timothy, his end is near. He even says that. He probably knows this is the last time that he will have any communication with Timothy. These are the last words he's going to say to Timothy. You don't waste your time. Now, he does seem to hope that Timothy will be able to get to him and bring him the cloaks and the parchment and stuff like that. But he also recognizes that may not happen. Make every effort to come to me soon, 2 Timothy 4:9. For Demas, having loved this present world, has deserted me and gone to Thessalonica. Now, I'm not going to go over this because we looked at Demas, I don't know, about 6 months or so ago in regards to apostasy. And it is very plain to me that Demas's abandonment, I mean, you look, Demas for me, abandoned, deserted. Loving the present age and has gone to Thessalonica. So the emphasis is upon me he has abandoned because he loved this present world. Crescens has gone to Galatia, Titus to Dalmatia. Nothing negative mentioned about them. Only Luke is with me. Pick up Mark and bring him with you, for he is useful to me for service. Now, there's a lot that could be said there. There's a lot about restored relationships. There's a lot about grace. There's a lot about, the whole concept of restoration and redemption, because it's obvious that the issue of Mark had been important in Paul's life. It had been what caused the dispute between Paul and Silas and Paul and Barnabas. And yet here, years down the road, peace has been made. Something has happened. Will we find out someday? I don't know. But something has happened, and Mark, who had been rejected by Paul for having turned back, is now considered useful to me for service. That there is a lot there about someone who has been, who fails in ministry and then gets a second chance. There's grace there. There's restoration. That's great. Tychicus I have sent to Ephesus. When you come, bring the cloak, which I left at Troas with Carpus, and the books, especially the parchments, the membranas, the parchments. Again, there's some all sorts of speculative stuff that's been done there. This is practical living stuff. And the parchments, would they have been blank parchments for writing or things that already been written? We don't know. There's all sorts of speculation about how all that works. But then we have this. Alexander the coppersmith did me much harm. The Lord repay him according to his deeds. Now, notice something. I noticed this while I was translating it. The term repay, apodosai, here in the Nestle 28th, is simply the future. So the Lord will repay him. He's stating a fact. But apodoe, which is found in the majority text, is subjunctive, so it's expressing the desire. May the Lord repay him according to his deeds. Not a major variant. There's a lot of places where the subjunctive and the future sort of coalesce and things like that. So, but you might see some difference in some translations as a result. The point is this. There is a man named Alexander the coppersmith, and we do not know whether Alexander was inside the church or outside the church, because you can interpret what is said either way. When it says he vigorously opposed our teaching, he did me much harm, those could be understood as Alexander was a coppersmith, and so he was part of the trade guilds, and the decrease in idolatry. You know, remember what happened with all the silversmiths and stuff like that, and causing major problems. So it's possible to read it that way. It's possible he was sort of like an early Celsus type guy that we're going to encounter in the second century later on, an inveterate enemy of the church who actually listens enough to find out something about what Christian belief is and starts mocking it, like you have in many atheists today, a few of which I've debated. Or he could have been within a church. Maybe his being called a coppersmith just means that he was not a quote-unquote professional minister, prophet, whatever it might be. But hence maybe had some funds. Sometimes people with money end up causing problems. A lot of ways they can end up causing problems. Maybe he was it doesn't specifically say he was part of the Judaizers. That's probably not the case. But he in some way vigorously opposes our words, literally. But our teaching and our doctrine would probably be the way to understand that. And what's interesting is, not only is this person's judgment announced, and Paul doesn't say, I hope he doesn't, I hope the Lord will be merciful to him or something. He doesn't say that. He says the Lord will repay him according to his deeds. it seems like there was a consistency in Alexander's behavior that would indicate he wasn't just a, you know, like, you know, Paul would go into the synagogue and he would present the gospel, and he would go in more than once, but there came a point in time where he said, okay, I've warned you, I've given you the message, now I'm going to the Gentiles. And he moves away. There comes a point in time when you have someone who is either a false teacher or is a person who is seeking to damage Christian ministry for whatever reasons, that the regularity of this behavior over time becomes indicative of a person who is truly in opposition and is going to be staying in that position. In other words, a person who's not so much an object of evangelism as an object of warning. And that's what Paul says to Timothy. Be on guard against him yourself. Be on guard, you, Timothy, him also you guard. So here's the type of person who, even with the passing of Paul, is not going to stop. The opposition is going to continue. And the next generation and the next generation, as long as that person's around. And so Paul says, he did me much harm. And it does cause us to sort of stop for a moment and wonder, why does the Lord allow this? Because every generation, here you have an apostle who's seeking to establish the church, and we would say he's doing so much good. Why would the Lord allow such a thorn in the flesh for one of his apostles? Well, Alexander wasn't the only one. I'm sure there were many, many, many. Paul had a long list of enemies. But the reality is that God has not decreed for his church that sail through calm waters upon calm seas with the light, fluffy clouds above. There are storms and there are challenges that have to be undertaken. And we know the name of one of those people in the early church, Alexander the Coppersmith. Not a good name to call somebody Alexander the Coppersmith, but they still live today. And they still do what they do. Notice the apostle was, I think, a hurt man. At my defense, no one showed up. No one showed up. But all deserted me. May it not be counted against them. Now, I don't know if Luke was there or not. Luke's with him now. But if Luke was there, even Luke didn't come, because there's something in that, not to them may it be credited, may it not be counted against them. Only way I can understand that phrase is that somebody should have been there, but they weren't. Why? Well, notice this, the Lord stood with me and strengthened me. The Lord will rescue me out of every evil deed, will bring me safely, will save me safely, literally. Sosai will save. That's sozo, soteriology. Will save me into his heavenly kingdom, and the presence of his glory forever and ever. So Paul didn't lose faith. The Lord stood with him. The Lord accomplished what he wanted to accomplish. But I cannot help but read, Demas has left me. He's abandoned me. At my first apologia, there it is. At my first apologia is how it would be pronounced in Greek. But my first apologia, nobody showed up. May it not, they all deserted me. And that's not a nice term. Because it's the exact same term used of Demas. So, ouch. 16. Well, it's related. No, it's the same one. Sorry. It's the exact same one. They deserted me. May it not be held against them. That's someone who's been abandoned by his friends. He was a human being. Lord stood with him. Lord strengthened him. But you don't think that he lost sleep over that? You don't think that he tossed and turned on that, whatever it was he laid on in that Roman prison cell? You better believe he did. And if the apostles experienced that, why should we expect beds of ease? Why should we be surprised that the Alexander the coppersmith, and here's the point. Why didn't they show up? Could it have been fear of the Romans? Of course. Could it also have been Paul is attacked so much? I want to keep my distance. I want to keep my distance. Keep my options open. Is that possible? I don't think we can tell necessarily from the text. But the point is this. When you have people like Alexander the coppersmith doing what Alexander the coppersmith does, the process is the punishment. So many people have been speaking against Paul, and so many lies would have been told about Paul, and so much slander would have been thrown his direction, that the natural tendency of a lot of people would be, I just don't want to get involved. And the result is here, one of the most important apostles of the Lord left alone at his defense, his first defense, left alone. Something to think about, something to consider. The apostle was not above feeling abandoned. And that's the term he used. Not only as someone who loved the present world and went after the things of that world, but even of brothers, because he said, may the Lord not hold it against them. He doesn't say, may the Lord not hold that against Demas, because he's loved this present age. But may the Lord not hold this against them, I think may have included Luke himself. I'd like to think that it didn't. I'd like to think that Luke was traveling, got there after the first offense. I don't know. There's always a way around everything if you want to. But the point is, this has been going on from the beginning, and we shouldn't be overly surprised by it. We should not be overly surprised by it. All right, so my plan, as things stand right now, is to do one more program this week on Friday at 11 in the morning, because in the afternoon I have to pick up the wife who's flying back in. She's up, should be up with the grandkids already. She takes her grandmotherly duties very seriously and has just made it her practice, even when Clementine lived in Georgia, to try to be out there wherever Clementine was for her birthday, which is tomorrow. In fact, it is birthday alley in our family between the grandkids and me. We've got it covered. 14th, 17th, and 19th, and two on the 19th, which is pretty amazing. So she's up there to have fun with the grandkids. I am a little bit jealous on that, but we're driving up on Monday, so I'll get to wrestle around with the kids, and I've been thinking about some stories to tell them. My favorite picture of 2017 on Facebook was the kids sitting on the couch, and I was telling them the purple ape story, which they still ask me to tell them. But once you've told the purple ape story, there's no going back to it. I mean, you can't do it more than once. It's just somewhat anticlimactic if you know what the end is. So, but if you don't, if you're going to be a grandfather and you don't know the Purple Ape story, it's a necessary study. Necessary. You just need to be prepared. Got to do it. So, anyways, so we're looking at 11 o'clock on Friday. Lord willing, we'll see you then. God bless.